Hello and welcome to the PCJ Media Archives. I'm Keith Powell. On November 22nd, 1990, British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher resigned. Margaret Thatcher recently has been in the news because of the film The Iron Lady that starred Meryl Streep. She also won an Academy Award for her performance as The Iron Lady. Margaret Thatcher is certainly a prime minister that people will not forget anytime soon. We now bring you a special broadcast the BBC World Service did on November 22nd, 1990. This was recorded at 13 hours UTC and was transmitted to North America. A special thank you to Boris Shidov for locating this recording in his archives.
"13 hours, Greenwich Mean Time.
BBC World Service. This is Max Easterman and Martin Hanley with a special 45-minute program of news and background to today's main story, the resignation of the British Prime Minister, Mrs. Margaret Thatcher. We'll be bringing you reaction from politicians across the political spectrum at Westminster, in Europe, and in the United States. And we'll have in-depth analysis from our studio team. But first, with the latest from the World Service newsroom, here's Martin Hanley.
Mrs. Thatcher said she would step down as soon as a new leader of the Conservative Party was elected. She told her cabinet colleagues of her decision this morning, less than a day after insisting she would fight on to retain the party leadership. She said Conservative unity and prospects of victory in a general election would be better served if she stood down to enable cabinet colleagues to enter the ballot for the leadership. Soon afterwards, two new candidates declared themselves, the Foreign Secretary, Mr. Douglas Hurd, and the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Mr. John Major. They will run against the only other candidate, the former Defence Secretary, Mr. Michael Heseltine. The second ballot takes place on Tuesday. Our political correspondent, Andrew Whitehead, looks at the momentous events of the past few days in British politics.
In spite of all Mrs. Thatcher's insistence that she'd fight on and fight to win, she's had to bow to the overwhelming mood of her party. After 15 years as leader of the Conservative Party, 11 years at number 10, she has clearly lost the confidence of Conservative MPs. It's the culmination of cabinet resignations, divisions over Europe, controversy over the poll tax, by-election setbacks, and above all, her failure to win an outright victory in Tuesday's first-round leadership ballot. Yesterday, party leaders and cabinet colleagues called on her. Many suggested she step down. Mrs. Thatcher made the final decision only this morning. She called an emergency cabinet at 9 o'clock and shortly after issued a statement in which she said that the unity of the Conservative Party and the prospects of a general election victory would be better served if she stood down. That has allowed two members of the cabinet to enter the leadership contest. The Foreign Secretary, Douglas Hurd, widely touted as a compromise candidate, put his name forward. So too has the Chancellor, John Major, just 47 years old, who'll get support from many on the centre-right of the party. Michael Heseltine, of course, will be standing again in Tuesday's second round of voting. Three candidates in all, one of whom will be Britain's next Prime Minister. So what is the legacy of Mrs. Thatcher's 11 years in power? It's difficult to overestimate her dominance of British politics, her free market economic policies, privatisations of state-owned industries, taming of the trade unions, a commanding figure on the international stage, staunchly anti-communist, yet with a good working relationship with President Gorbachev, the victor of the Falklands War. And while she may now be seen by her colleagues as an electoral liability, Mrs. Thatcher did take the Conservative Party to three successive election victories, an achievement without parallel in the modern era.
So, three men are in the race to become the next Prime Minister. Michael Heseltine, Douglas Hurd and John Major. Our correspondent Clive Marden looks at the credentials of those who would follow Mrs. Thatcher into 10 Downing Street.
Michael Heseltine is a man of flamboyant image, popularly known as Tarzan. He's tall and always elegantly dressed. A self-made millionaire, Mr. Heseltine is proud of the magazine and property interests which made him rich. But no less flamboyant than Mr. Heseltine's appearance is his oratory, which has brought him standing ovations at successive Conservative Party conferences. Politically, he has a reputation of being a caring capitalist who's been responsible for a number of initiatives to improve the lot of the inner cities. And as Environment Secretary in the early 1980s, he warned against the idea of the poll tax. On Europe, Mr. Heseltine favours the single currency and closer monetary cooperation, and it was his championing of a European cooperative answer to Westland Helicopters' troubles which led to his clash with the government in 1986. Ever since that dramatic resignation, Michael Heseltine has waited in the wings, ready to re-enter the fray. There's no doubt that the first of the second-round candidates, Mr. Douglas Hurd, is a thoroughbred, an old Etonian, the son and grandson of Conservative MPs, with the first in history at Cambridge, a former diplomat and an accomplished writer of thrillers. On a number of occasions, luck has played a part in some of his tough political jobs. Northern Ireland secretary, while the Anglo-Irish agreement was being negotiated, he was moved before the pact was signed, and he ceased to be Home Secretary before record crime figures were announced. Mr. Hurd was appointed Minister of State in the Foreign Office when Mrs. Thatcher took power in 1979. He stayed there for 4 years before moving sideways to a similar post in the Home Office. Much later, as Home Secretary, he was one of the busiest ministers in government, responsible for reforming the official secrecy laws and, among other things, bringing back all-day opening in British pubs. It was in his 60th year, and after the resignation of the then-Chancellor Nigel Lawson, that he achieved his long-standing ambition of directing Britain's foreign policy. Recent comments have shown him to be a supporter of Sir Geoffrey Howe's views on Europe, which have been so much at the heart of the government's present problems. John Major, by contrast, is a much younger man with very different background. At 47, referred to sometimes as a modest workaholic, the Chancellor recently raised eyebrows when he admitted that he once missed out on a job as a bus conductor because he was too slow in a maths test. He left school at 16 to work for the Electricity Board as a labourer while most of his future ministerial colleagues went to Oxford or Cambridge. He was elected to Lambeth Council in London and in 1979 won a place in Parliament. He was catapulted into number 11 Downing Street just over a year ago, following Mr. Lawson's resignation, and it was him, amongst others, who persuaded Mrs. Thatcher to lift her veto so he could take sterling into the exchange rate mechanism of the European monetary system. Now Mr. Major is regarded as a man with almost no enemies. He's implemented an anti-inflation program that's led to an economic recession without attracting odium, and he disperses criticism with an amiability that conceals a powerful will.
Throughout the morning, politicians of all parties have been expressing their thoughts on the end of the Thatcher era. Our correspondent Catherine Utley has been listening to what they had to say.
Mrs. Thatcher's announcement came as a shock to politicians of all persuasions. There were many in the Conservative Party who believed yesterday that she would step down then. But when she returned from Paris saying that she would fight on and fight to win, they believed her. Minutes after the announcement came this morning, friends and foes within her party were paying tribute to the Prime Minister who has served her country for more than 11 years and led her party to 3 general election victories. One of the first to give his reaction was the Conservative Party party chairman, Mr. Kenneth Baker.
This is a typically brave and selfless decision by the Prime Minister. Once again, Margaret Thatcher has put her country's and party's interests before personal considerations. This will allow the party to elect a new leader who will unite the party and build upon her immense successes.
Some backbenchers could hardly contain their emotion. The right-wing MP Nicholas Winterton said Mrs. Thatcher's resignation was a catastrophe for the country. The Conservative Party, he said, was creating political suicide. Another, Ivan Lawrence, said he was dumbfounded. Had Mrs. Thatcher fought on, she would have swept to victory, he said. But for the majority, there was, with all the sadness, a sense of relief that she had given up the fight and left the way open for other candidates to come forward in the leadership contest. Mr. Michael Heseltine himself, until this morning Mrs. Thatcher's only challenger, said he welcomed the news, but he also had praise for Mrs. Thatcher.
May I say at once that this brings to an end a quite remarkable premiership. She has made a remarkable contribution to Britain's history and has led this country with great distinction in the 1980s. The resignation about which we've just heard now opens the way for an election for the vacancy of leader of the Conservative Party, which will enable others to come forward. I very much welcome that. I would expect my own name to be still there, as it has already been nominated, and we will then find a way of uniting the Conservative Party and going on to win the next general election.
The Labour Party said it was delighted with the news. The party leader, Mr. Neil Kinnock, said it was now essential that a general election be called.
It's very good news indeed. It's news that I've been waiting for and millions of people in Britain have been waiting for a long time. We should have a general election right away because apart from my delight, it is the British people who should decide upon the new government.
The leader of the Liberal Democrats, Mr. Paddy Ashdown, expressed the views of many when he said that this morning's announcement was a historic moment.
She has taken the right decision for her own reputation, a remarkable reputation, for the unity of her party and for the good of our country. Britain now, I think, recognises that the historic moment has arrived when the era of Thatcherism is over. We must now turn our attention to the new agenda, the new ideas and the new political parties of the 1990s.
The leader of the Liberal Democrats, Mr. Paddy Ashdown. The announcement of Mrs. Thatcher's resignation seems to have caught everybody by surprise. Our foreign affairs correspondent, Jack Thompson, has been monitoring the initial reactions from around the world.
A reaction from the President of the European Commission, Jacques Delors, was conveyed by the British Vice President, Sir Leon Britton. He said Mr. Delors had been shocked by the news, but had then added, quite spontaneously, that he'd an overwhelming feeling of immense regard and esteem for Mrs. Thatcher, in spite of past differences with her. That's a generous tribute from a man whose proposals for the integration of the community, not least for a social charter, were the butt of some stinging attacks from the British Prime Minister. In a reference to the election for the leadership of the Conservative Party and the choice of candidates, another European official, who for obvious reasons preferred to remain anonymous, said anyone was better than Mrs. Thatcher. President Bush has already referred to Mrs. Thatcher's fibre and steel, a description of the way she stayed cool, calm and collected during this week's Paris summit, notwithstanding heavy domestic political pressures. One of America's leading daily papers, the New York Times, before the resignation announcement, ran the headline, Maggie's Rule Wavers in Britannia. The Canadian Prime Minister, Mr. Mulroney, said there'd been a general sense of sadness in Paris and good wishes for Mrs. Thatcher from everybody. French, German and Italian newspapers, almost without exception, appear to have spotted the end of the Thatcher era. There's one country in which reaction to Mrs. Thatcher's departure must be entirely predictable, Saddam Hussein's Iraq. There, the Prime Minister has been seen, alongside President Bush, as the arch enemy. The language of the state-controlled Iraqi media has been abusive in the extreme. It's unlikely to change.
Margaret Thatcher's resignation comes 32 years after she entered Parliament. Our correspondent Harold Briley was there when she made her maiden speech, and he's covered highlights of her career since. Here's his report.
In her sparsely attended House of Commons, in her very first speech, she made immediate impact on the few of us there. This then unknown MP, very young, very smart, obviously very competent. In those far-off days, it never entered anyone's mind that she or any woman could be Prime Minister, as she herself said.
I don't think there'll be a woman Prime Minister in my lifetime, as far as I can see.
How wrong she was as she stormed the commanding heights of domestic and international politics, breaking records as the longest-serving Prime Minister of modern times. She had a tough time consolidating her leadership in opposition because the man she toppled, Ted Heath, was bitterly unhelpful. The turning point consolidating her leadership came with her Iron Lady speech attacking the Soviet Union. Though she reveled in that nickname in public, she often confided to me in private her regret that she was widely regarded as lacking compassion when she said she felt deeply about other people. That compassion she showed most unashamedly in mourning the loss of victims of the IRA. Among them, close colleagues such as Ian Gow and Erie Neave, who masterminded her successful leadership bid against Ted Heath. She was an IRA target herself, dangerously exposed, as demonstrated by the 1984 Brighton bombing, which killed several of her Conservative colleagues.
The fact that we are gathered here now, shocked, but composed and determined, is a sign not only that this attack has failed, but that all attempts to destroy democracy by terrorism will fail.
She defeated the Argentine military dictatorship in the Falklands conflict. She took on and reformed the trade unions and denationalized state-owned industry and vigorously fought Britain's corner in the European community.
We have not successfully rolled back the frontiers of the state in Britain, only to see them reimposed at a European level, with a European superstate exercising a new dominance from Brussels.
Europe was an issue which split her party and helped to end her reign. She transformed her early hostility to the Soviet Union into friendship and support for Mr. Gorbachev in his radical reforms. She's won a place in the history books, not just as a colossus in domestic politics, but also on the world stage. However much people have criticized her style and some of her policies, no one can gainsay her resolution and courage.
Mrs. Thatcher's resignation has been accepted favorably in the City of London, the financial heart of Britain. Share prices and the pound both rose. Our economics correspondent James Morgan reports on why the departure of a leader widely regarded as the best friend business has had at No. 10 Downing Street is taken so calmly.
Mrs. Thatcher revolutionized the way the British economy operates. British industry is more efficient and more profitable. London has boomed as a financial center. Millionaires have been created by the score, income tax cut, and the budget deficit eliminated. The combination of sound finance, lower taxes, and an expanding economy, together with the disappearance of socialism, should have ensured total commitment to the person of Mrs. Thatcher in the wealth-creating or money-making classes. But it didn't, partly because most of the successes were achieved during the first two terms of Mrs. Thatcher's administration. The last 4 years have seen the problems. The reorientation of local property tax made her unpopular and provided new burdens for business. The economic boom turned into an inflationary fever. The government itself had to engineer a recession that's now leading to business closures and higher unemployment in many parts of the country. Then there's the controversy over Europe. Most employers and businessmen feel no more enthusiastic about a single currency for the community than does the Prime Minister herself. But they recognize realities that they believe Mrs. Thatcher ignores. Europeans have to be treated as friends. The announcement of her departure was coupled with signs that interest rates could fall. It's believed that the Treasury is already ensuring the new leader comes in on a wave of good news.
You can hear more about the reaction of the markets to Mrs. Thatcher's resignation later in the programme. And now, back to Max Eastman.
Martin Hanley, thank you very much. Well, reaction at Westminster to the news of Mrs. Thatcher's decision to step down has come fast and furious. Whilst it wasn't entirely an uncanvassed possibility, it did take many members of Parliament by surprise, especially some of Mrs. Thatcher's more loyal supporters. This was the reaction of her first foreign secretary, and incidentally the first man to resign from her cabinet in his case on a matter of personal honour over the Falklands, Lord Carrington.
Well, the sadness that a great period of her prime ministership is over in this way. And I don't think one should ever forget what this country owes to her over these last 11 years and what she inherited when she first started. So it's one of sadness.
Lord Carrington. Well, I'm joined now on the line from Westminster by Ivan Lawrence, a prominent Tory backbencher and a supporter of Margaret Thatcher. Mr. Lawrence, has she done the right thing?
No, because I'm absolutely astounded that she should have been given this kind of advice. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind at all that she would have strengthened her position and swept a victory in the ballot on Tuesday. She only just lost by 4 votes last time from being 52 vote ahead, and therefore was what the public would understand to be an absolute winner. And yet somehow or other we've managed to contrive not only to put question mark over that, but to force her into resignation, which I think is the most astonishing and hurtful thing, not only for her and the Conservative Party, but for the nation.
Well, why do you think it was that the Cabinet effectively withdrew support from her last night?
The short answer is she appointed the wrong people to the Cabinet.
Well, we now have 3 contenders for the Crown. 2 of them are present Cabinet members, Mr. Hurd, Mr. Major. Do you fear that those 2 will split the anti-Heseltine vote and let Mr. Heseltine in?
No, I don't think Mr. Heseltine will win the next round. Firstly, because he's the hatchet man and therefore expendable. Secondly, because we've been told day and night by the media that a lot of people voted for him not because they wanted him to win, but because they wanted to vote against Mrs. Thatcher and to let Mr. Hurd and Mr. Major in. And if that is so, then a lot of people who voted for Michael Heseltine will go to either John Major or Douglas Hurd, and of course a lot of Mrs. Thatcher's votes will go to John Major and Douglas Hurd. Very few of those will go to Michael Heseltine, so I'm afraid, well, I'm not afraid, but I think the situation is that he will be expended and the fight will be between Douglas Hurd and John Major.
Mr. Lawrence, finally and very briefly, who will you vote for?
Well, for me, the unthinkable has happened, that this great Conservative Party has hacked down in her prime the finest Prime Minister this country has had in peacetime this century. It's so unthinkable that I haven't yet had time to gather my thoughts and decide who I think would be best to unite the party and would be best for Britain. But over the course of the next few days, of course, I shall concentrate my mind on that, and then I might be able to answer your question.
Happy concentrating, Mr. Lawrence. Thank you very much indeed. Well, as we now know, there are three contenders for Mrs. Thatcher's crown: Douglas Hurd, John Major, and, of course, Michael Heseltine. Early this morning, I talked to one of Mr. Heseltine's key supporters, Peter Temple Morris. He felt the resignation of Mrs. Thatcher, and like Mr. Lawrence, was timely. The verdict of the party was conclusive. So why, I asked him, did he think the cabinet deserted Mrs. Thatcher after she had declared her intention to fight on?
I think that after the verdict of the party, the loyalty, obvious loyalty obligation of us all, particularly the cabinet, really translates into a loyalty to the party overall. And that loyalty means, of course, not dividing any more than is absolutely necessary in this very difficult situation, and also winning the next election. And following that on just one stage further, it was therefore very important that there should be a full election with all available candidates. That's far the best thing for the party. Nobody can grumble after the event that so-and-so didn't stand. And we will unite that much more easily behind the new leader.
What do you think Mr. Heseltine's chances are with one obviously very strong candidate, Mr. Hurd, against him, one of a less known quantity, Mr. Major, but nonetheless a man who clearly has a bright political future ahead of him?
Oh, I think that that's right, that John Major has a bright political future ahead of him, and some would say that not just yet, and next time might be the right time. I think John Major is undoubtedly a potential leader of the future. But as far as Michael Heseltine is concerned, he has the entrenched position of the first ballot. He is doing, in effect, exactly what Margaret Thatcher did when she defeated Edward Heath. And when Willie Whitelaw came into the race, it was too late for Willie Whitelaw. The other very important point here, I think, is that Michael Heseltine has the credibility to stand, in the sense that he has been detached from Margaret Thatcher's government since January of 1986. He is the person to roll the sleeves up and deal with the poll tax or the inner cities or anything else, has the prospectus to do so. With regard to any other candidate from the cabinet, it was only yesterday, if you like, that they were actively associating themselves with what had gone before. It's not very long, therefore. They've got about 4 days to separate themselves from the immediate past.
That was Peter Temple Morris, supporter of Michael Heseltine. Well, now, Mrs. Thatcher has a busy afternoon in Parliament. She'll be answering Prime Minister's questions and then facing a motion of no confidence put down by the Labour Party. Labour had clearly hoped by so doing to rally the Conservatives behind Margaret Thatcher and thus make it easier for them to win at a general election. But the stratagem has failed. I asked Labour's transport spokesman, John Prescott, for his reaction to the manner of the ladies going.
No, I think it's very typical of her, isn't it? This woman's years in office have basically been about how she gets her own way. And in these circumstances, it hasn't occurred, and she's been told she's got to go, but she's been quite prepared to subordinate national interest and party interest to her demands.
What do you think of the candidates who now face the Conservative MP voters? Which one of them worries you most?
None of them, frankly, because whilst I have a preference as an opposition spokesman to fight an election with a leader of the opposite party who's unpopular, I don't know what the position is of the electorate to all these three candidates.
Even so, the opinion polls have been suggesting that with Michael Heseltine in charge, the only candidate there was until this morning, the Conservatives would be ahead of Labour and would be more likely to win the general election.
Well, I don't think we could really tell at this stage, can we, to be quite frank. Opinion polls are reflecting how people feel at the moment. Massive relief, a desire and hope that she's going to be moved. And any candidate, and Heseltine was the only one there, has been reflected in the polls. The bitterness in the Tory party is going to be very, very considerable, particularly if it was Heseltine. There's a reason why I think there'll be a big groundswell of support for people like Hurd. And he's more of a grey man in a grey suit than perhaps Mr. Heseltine is, so we just have to wait and see what happens.
That was John Prescott of the Labour Party. Well, now I'm joined on the line from his office in Westminster by the President of the Liberal Democrat Party, Charles Kennedy. Mr. Kennedy, did you agree with what John Prescott had to say? Do you think Mr. Hurd, in the end, is going to sweep the board?
No, I don't, actually. I'm based on my own, it has to be said, most unscientific opinion poll conducted in the course of the last hour or so of Conservative backbenchers around the corridors of Westminster. I think the Cabinet are making a bit of a strategic mistake because there's been a flurry of Cabinet ministers on the media, all saying now the choice is John Major or Douglas Hurd. They're engaged in a rather desperate rearguard Cabinet action to try and stop Heseltine. And yet I've literally, just before coming on the line to you, been speaking to a Tory backbench MP who voted Thatcher on the first ballot and now proposes to vote Heseltine on the second ballot, simply because he was the man who had the guts to go in the first place, and he thinks he's the kind of man with that kind of guts who will be best to lead them in an election campaign.
Can you briefly tell me who you think will be best for the Liberal Democrats?
The $64 question. I think probably John Major or Douglas Hurd would both be rather weak in terms of having the sort of charisma and the voter appeal during an election. I think Mr. Heseltine would be the most dangerous. Therefore, if I was a Tory backbencher, worried about holding my seat, worried about the government winning the next election, I think I would vote Heseltine. I would not be at all surprised, despite having the full force of the Cabinet and the Prime Minister against him, if Michael Heseltine comes through.
Thank you very much indeed, Charles Kennedy, President of the Liberal Democrats. Well, it is 50 years since the Prime Minister has been cast out by her own side. Maybe, in the end, that will be one of the events for which Margaret Thatcher is longest remembered. There are some commentators, after all, prepared to write off the Thatcher era as a mere blip in the historical record. But on balance, it's likely that the first woman Prime Minister, the longest serving of modern times, arguably the most radical, and the one who gave the word Thatcherism to the language, will feature large in the history books for a while yet. She entered Westminster in 1959. By 1970, she was Secretary of State for Education under Edward Heath.
I don't think there'll be a woman Prime Minister in my lifetime, as far as I can see.
Well, that was probably her last understatement. 4 years later, the daughter of the Grantham grocer took on her party leader and defeated him. British politics had its first woman party leader, and in May 1979, she reaped the harvest of Jim Callaghan's winter of discontent.
Her Majesty, the Queen, has asked me to form a new administration, and I have accepted. It is, of course, the greatest honour that can come to any citizen in a democracy.
Citizen Thatcher pursued right-wing economic policies. Unemployment rose rapidly and her popularity sank equally fast. She was saved from a general election defeat by an Argentine general, Galtieri, who invaded the Falkland Islands and presented the Iron Lady, as she was now universally known, with a cause to rally the country to. She beat Argentina, beat her opponents in the 83 general election, beat the miners in a bitter year-long confrontation. Then in 1984, another enemy nearly finished her with a bomb in her conference hotel in Brighton.
The fact that we are gathered here now, shocked, but composed and determined, is a sign not only that this attack has failed, but that all attempts to destroy democracy by terrorism will fail.
Outside Britain, Mrs. Thatcher forged very close personal links with US President Reagan, with Mikhail Gorbachev, and was widely seen as a leader of great stature. Only in the European community did she attract criticism. She fought for Britain's rights, but then stood firm against further integration.
We have not successfully rolled back the frontiers of the state in Britain, only to see them reimposed at a European level, with a European superstate exercising a new dominance from Brussels.
This, in the end, was the issue which sank her. Michael Heseltine, Leon Britton, Nigel Lawson and Nicholas Ridley all either chose or had to leave her cabinet over Europe. Her attitude to Commission President Jacques Delors was equally uncompromising.
He wanted the European Parliament to be the democratic body of the community. He wanted the Commission to be the executive, and he wanted the Council of Ministers to be the Senate. No. No. No.
So let's turn to reaction from abroad. One of her closest political allies in Europe has been German Chancellor Helmut Kohl. But they've not seen eye to eye on political and monetary union. The General Secretary of Chancellor Kohl's party, the Christian Democrats, gave this reaction to Mrs. Thatcher's departure.
Everybody has to go sometime. And I think it is the right step after the results of this week and the chance for a new beginning and for victory for the Conservative Party, which is very important for stability in Europe because the Labour is not credible with regard to Europe.
That was the first reaction from Europe, from Volker Rühe, and the first reaction from Brussels, from the European Commission, came from Sir Leon Britton, who resigned from Mrs. Thatcher's government over the Westland affair.
Shock to start with, and then the President quite spontaneously said that his overwhelming feeling was one of immense regard and esteem for Mrs. Thatcher in spite of the differences that he'd had with her. And it was then agreed that although it would be not right for the Commission as such to intervene in the British domestic political scene, it was felt that if I, on behalf of the Commission, conveyed that message, that would be right.
European Commissioner Sir Leon Britton. And now I'm joined on the line, the transatlantic line, by Caspar Weinberger, who was the Secretary of Defense in President Reagan's administration. Mr. Weinberger, what is your reaction to the departure of President Reagan's very close friend?
Well, I was frankly horrified. I had hoped that after the results of the first ballot, when she clearly had a very large majority of her party, that the rest would rally around and that she would continue on and on, as she used to like to say, and lead the party into another general election victory. But it is true, she's been one of the very greatest friends we've had, and she was in at a critically important time and made an enormous change in Great Britain internally and externally.
That is very true, but how do you think the president, George Bush, is going to react, and what effects will it have, in fact, on his policies in the next few months?
Well, I hope it will not have any effect on his policies. I hope that whoever succeeds her will continue to support, as she has done, the policies in the Mideast and elsewhere. She has been, as I said, one of our greatest supporters and took courses many times that were politically unpopular for her because she thought it was right to support us. For example, when the planes that had to attack Libya were based in Great Britain, she authorized without any hesitancy their use in that particular capacity, whereas France did not, and we had to fly about close to 3,400 miles out of our way because we couldn't go over French territory. That was just one example of the kind of unflinching support we had from her, even though she knew it was politically unpopular. I would very much hope that whoever succeeds will have the same kind of regard for the causes of freedom and the policies that we've always tried to espouse, and I'm sure they will.
Caspar Weinberger, thank you very much indeed. Former Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger. Now, let's look at the latest financial news and market reactions to the resignation of Margaret Thatcher. Here's Martin Webber.
Well, the immediate reaction of London share prices was to rise strongly amid relief that the uncertainty over her future had been removed. The 100-share index, which had been 11 points higher before the news, surged 34 points ahead. But prices have since eased back again. The 100-share index is currently up just 9.4 at 2135.7. Even more important is the reaction of the foreign exchanges. Any slide in the value of the pound could force British interest rates higher at a time when the economy is facing recession. So joining me on the line now is David Cocker of Chemical Bank in London. David, did the pound go up or down?
The pound moved up immediately after Mrs. Thatcher's resignation announcement. It rose almost a cent against the dollar to 1.98 and about a pfennig and a half against the Deutschmark to just over 2.92. When Mr. Major threw his hat in the ring so it became not just a two-cornered but a three-cornered fight at the next round, sterling began to slide back down again and dropped as low as about 2.91, but subsequently has begun to rise yet again.
As we've been hearing around the world, Mrs. Thatcher is generally a much respected figure, so why has her departure not led to any real loss of confidence in sterling?
In March market terms, I think it has to do with her approach towards Europe and the fact that the markets really did not believe that she would defend the bottom band of sterling's level against the Deutschmark. And I think, therefore, with whoever gets into power now as the leader, the perception is that the Conservative Party will unite behind her and now have an extremely good chance of winning the next general election, whenever that may happen to be.
David, thank you very much. That's all from me. Now back to Max Easterman.
Martin Weber of Our Financial Unit. Now let's take a look at the rest of today's world news. Here's Roy Lama.
President Bush is in Saudi Arabia visiting American troops in the multinational force deployed against Iraq. His first stop was at a huge airbase near Dawran in the eastern part of the country. Our correspondent, Jeremy Harris, is traveling with the president's party.
Mr. Bush emerged from Air Force One, casually dressed in an open-necked blue shirt and bareheaded in the 90-degree heat. The airmen and women waiting on the shimmering tarmac gave him a raucous welcome. Mr. Bush told them they were there to protect freedom, the future, and innocent lives.
What we're confronting is a classic bully who thinks he can get away with kicking sand in the face of the world. And so far we have acted with restraint, as is our way. But Saddam is making the mistake of his life if he confuses an abundance of restraint and patience with a lack of resolve.
Mr. Bush said every day brought the Iraqi leader closer to his goal of a nuclear arsenal, and that gave the U.S. mission in the Gulf a real sense of urgency. The president then headed for an army outpost deep in the desert and a Thanksgiving Day service on the flight deck of an American warship.
President Saddam Hussein has issued a statement to coincide with Mr. Bush's trip, saying he will destroy the American leader. In Bonn, the German Chancellor, Dr. Kohl, told Parliament that the time was ripe for negotiations to solve the other conflicts of the Middle East. President Bush himself will travel on to Egypt later today for talks with President Mubarak. Diplomats in Peking say the Soviet foreign minister, Mr. Edward Shevardnadze, is to visit China on Friday. They say he will meet the Chinese foreign minister, Mr. Qian Qichun, in the western city of Urumqi. The BBC's Peking correspondent says the two men are expected to discuss whether the Soviet Union and China should back moves in the United Nations Security Council to endorse the possible use of force against Iraq. China has announced that it has stopped supplying weapons to the guerrilla forces in Cambodia. A foreign ministry spokesman in Peking said China had not supplied any military assistance to the guerrillas since the adoption of the United Nations peace plan in August. The spokesman was responding to a report that the largest guerrilla group, the Khmer Rouge, recently received deliveries of tanks and other heavy artillery from China. Here's our Peking correspondent, James Miles.
China has been the main supplier of weapons to the guerrillas since the Vietnamese invaded Cambodia in 1978 and toppled the Khmer Rouge government, which was supported by Peking. Western diplomats say it's possible that Chinese weapons already in the pipeline before the UN peace plan was adopted are still reaching the guerrillas, but they say there's no firm evidence that any new shipments have been made since then. For many years, China said it would continue its aid to the guerrillas until the Vietnamese had completely withdrawn. In recent months, however, China has been gradually softening its position, even though it disputes Hanoi's claim that all Vietnamese troops withdrew from Cambodia in September last year. One reason for the change in China's position has been the easing of tension between Peking and Moscow, Vietnam's main ally. And in recent weeks, China's relations with Vietnam itself have shown signs of considerable improvement.
Reports from the South African homeland of Transkei say the coup attempt that began early this morning has been crushed. The South African press agency said troops loyal to Transkei's leader, General Bantu Holomisa, stormed a building in the capital, Umtata, where a group of rebels had been holding out. It had earlier been reported that the leader of the coup, Colonel Craig Dooley, had been captured, but General Holomisa is now quoted as saying that Colonel Dooley is still free. The coup began when rebels attacked an army base near Umtata. Later, shooting was heard in the capital itself. The Danish Prime Minister, Mr. Poul Schlüter, has called a snap general election for December the 12th. The decision follows the breakdown of talks between his centre-right coalition and the main opposition Social Democrats over tax changes. They agreed on cuts in income tax at the top of the scale to bring it into line with other European community countries, but disagreed on how to pay for this. That's the world news. Now back to you, Max.
Thank you very much indeed, Roy Lauer. Well, I'm joined now in the studio by Andrew Whitehead, the BBC's political correspondent, and Professor George Jones, Professor of Government at the London School of Economics. Andrew, if I can come to you first, what actually happens now?
The Conservative Party holds a second leadership ballot next Tuesday. We know there are three candidates, the Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd, the Chancellor John Major, Michael Heseltine, the challenger as well. One of them will be Britain's new Prime Minister. It may not be decided, though, on Tuesday. To win on Tuesday, the winning candidate's got to get at least 187 votes. That's half of all Conservative MPs. I think it may well go to a third ballot, which will be held a week today, and when a transferable vote system comes into operation.
Well, we've heard a lot from Michael Heseltine over the past few days. Let's hear a little about one of the other contenders. In a brief statement, Douglas Hurd said a few minutes ago that the task for the next leader was to unite the party in handling present problems and winning the next election.
I believe that I can do that, and that is why I'm putting my name forward. We've got, as a country, hard tests ahead of us at home, in Europe, and in the Gulf. And all Conservatives believe that we have a strong duty to the country to prevent the election of a Labour government under Neil Kinnock, who is the most lightweight Labour leader there's ever been. I supported the Prime Minister fully until the moment of her decision this morning. What we've got to do now is build on her successes. I understand that John Major is putting forward his name also today. He and I have kept in very close touch throughout this contest. We've worked together in the past. We shall work together in the future. He is and he will remain a good friend and a strong colleague.
Well, that was Douglas Hurd, and we've just also received this statement from the other man who's thrown his hat in the ring, John Major.
But I'm extremely sorry that the Prime Minister has decided to resign. She had my full support in the first ballot. I had seconded her for the second ballot. And I'm sorry that she has taken the decision in the interests of unity and the party that she is not to go on. I think she will be seen by history as a very great Prime Minister indeed, with a very considerable number of achievements. I think our job now is to try and build on those achievements. I believe I would like the opportunity of trying to unite the party. A lot of colleagues have suggested to me that I may be able to do so. And so I have decided to let my name go forward in the ballot for leadership of the Conservative Party. It is now a matter for my colleagues to decide.
John Major sounding very modest there, Professor Jones. Now, you were tipping Sir Geoffrey Howe as the man who would solve this leadership crisis 2 days ago. He hasn't. What do you think is the reason for him not coming forward, and why do you think Mr. Hurd and Mr. Major have decided to?
Well, I'm mystified about Sir Geoffrey Howe. Perhaps the real reason is that he realises that those people who are very close to Mrs. Thatcher would not support him because he is regarded as the one who provoked this crisis by his resignation and above all by that resignation speech which blew the gaff on the way she conducted government. It looks to me now like Mr. Hurd. Because he's much more the senior figure, he's much more senior, more authoritative than Mr. Major. Mr. Major hasn't been in Parliament very long. And Hurd is also somebody who's likely to bring the different factions of the party together. He used to be a Heathite. He was very closely associated with Mr. Heath. He moved over much more to Mrs. Thatcher. But he hasn't made enemies. He's kept out of a lot of the internal confrontations.
Well, let's take a European view of this. Now, on the line from Strasbourg is the European editor of The Guardian, John Palmer. John, how do you think Europe will react, and who will be preferred, Hurd, Major, or Heseltine?
Well, I think the attitude of the great majority of European politicians, members of the European Parliament, the other European community governments, and distinguished members of the European Commission is that it matters less which of the three candidates wins than that there is a fairly radical change in the British government's policy towards Europe. I think privately many of them believe that the best chance of securing that radical change in stance and strategy towards Europe may lie with the election of Douglas Hurd, who's convinced a lot of people in other European capitals that he is committed to the goals of European Union, whereas, of course, Mrs. Thatcher was clearly not so convinced. And perhaps Mr. Major remains at least ambiguous about those long-term objectives.
John Palmer, thank you very much for joining us.
If you enjoy the program that you just heard, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is pcjmedia@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.